their mom would say they would be upset.
What does that do to your mother?
Mary Slava.
Mary Slava is British. She
thinks it's the person who just got shot.
That's Mary, chairperson of the hospitality thing.
And I need somebody to make coffee for next Sunday. You can sign up down on the landing. There's a bulletin board and there's a sheet you can sign up. There are instructions downstairs in the summer to make the coffee. And also, if you have that, it's
yes, I want to say that back newsletter is late due to the weather. We've extended the time of getting a meeting for the directory supplement. So if you have anything to say to me about being in the directory or having a meeting, you can do it today here, and I'll be back here on the
This is a church directory that comes out annually.
Which should be out annually, and this is also late, not due to the weather. Right.
Thank you. The listeners came up all the way from South Wisconsin. Did you bring this lovely weather? Are there other announcements? Ron Slabo.
Well, I was asked to start the program this morning by greeting back the program chairpersons by leading us in a singing few words that just disappeared coming down the blackboard. Shalom, Havarim. Why don't we do it? We'll sing it together once and then do it in a two-part round, split it down the aisle.
This is a slide of Nazareth to go with it to welcome the Calvins back in.
Bye.
so you're just going to stand there. Very good. Very good.
You can look over her shoulder.
Entering
could happen was like sticking one's nose into one of those souvenir pillows filled with balsam needles or cedar chips that they made for tourists back home in Asheville. Fairlife Spencer had arranged galaxies in two old clear bowls, the leaves mostly bronze and one in red from the winter. Here and there, blue green, and in a chip bowl, she had put trillium in violets. The very first, she told us, and unselfconsciously reached out slender fingers to caress the flowers, the reasons of the springtime. The grace of the gesture and the long tapering fingers, even though they were red and rough, with chipped and broken nails, caught my attention. I stood there thinking that these should be the hands of a lady handling an ivory fan or smoothing her skirts in velvet or satin. They were the hands of an aristocrat, and here they were on a mountain woman, buried at the back of beyond. Today, she was eager to show me everything, including an unusual quilt stretched on a quilting frame near the hearth. So while David was talking to 15-year-old John, teasing him ruffling his hair, I was examining the quilt. It was not the commonplace hip and miss patchwork, but a moon and star motif. When I asked Mrs. Spencer about it, she pointed to a small window set high in the wall to the right of the fireplace. See that lookout? I get a heap of joy from that. When I'm lonesome like, it hurts me up to look up there and see the sun ball and moon and stars. So twice one night, I brought you an idea. Please picture pretty of the new moon and the star. I looked at her in astonishment. Mrs. Spencer, you mean you drew a picture of the new moon at three different positions and then copied that onto your quilt? She nodded. Very much work. Seems right nice to have the starry heavens on my home.
I'm reading from the bed quilt by Dorothy Canfield Fisher. It's about an old maid who works hard for the family of her brother and her sister-in-law until one day she has her life's inspiration. She never knew how her great idea came to her. Sometimes she thought she must have dreamed it. Sometimes she even wondered reverently in the phraseology of the weekly prayer meeting if it had not been sent to her. She never admitted to herself that she could have thought of it without other help. It was too great, too ambitious, too lofty a project for her humble mind to have conceived. Even when she finished drawing the design with her own fingers, she gazed at it incredulously, not daring to believe that it could indeed be her handiwork. At first, it seemed to her only like a lovely but unreal dream. For a long time, she did not once think of putting an actual quilt together following the pattern, even though she herself had invented it. It was not that she feared the prodigious effort that would be needed to get those tiny, oddly shaded pieces of bright colored material sewed together with the perfection of fine workmanship needed. No, she thought zestfully and eagerly of such endless effort, her heart uplifted by her vision of the mosaic beauty of the whole creation as she saw it when she shut her eyes to dream of it, that complicated, splendidly difficult pattern good enough for the angels in heaven to quilt. So the old maid sits down and starts a pattern. And the next day, her big, rough, tough sister-in-law astonished her by taking the huge pan of potatoes out of her lap and setting one of the younger children to peeling it. "Don't you want to go on with that quilting pattern?" she said. "I kind of like to see how you're going to make that grapevine design come out in the corner." For the first time in her life, the dependent old maid contradicted her powerful sister-in-law. Quickly and jealously, she said, "It's not grapevine. It's a sort of curlicue I made up." "Well, it's nice looking anyhow," said Sophia pacifyingly. "I never could have made it up." So for 5 years, Miss Mehetabel, the old maid aunt, sews. And it literally takes that long. And at the end of 5 years, they all decide to go and to hang her quilt in the country fair. And so for the first time in her life, Miss Mehetabel goes to the country fair And when she comes back, all the family asks her, did she see the exhibits? Did she see all the beautiful exhibits, all of the whole fair? And it turns out, no, she'd been sitting in front of the quilt. Didn't you go see anything else, they asked? Why no, said Mary Bell, only the quilt. Why should I? She fell into a reverie. As if it hung again before her eyes, she saw the glory that shone around the creation of her hand and brain. She longed to make her listeners share the golden vision with her. Vague recollections of hymn book phrases came into her mind. They were the only kind of poetic expression she knew, but they were dismissed as being sacrilegious to use for something in real life, also as not being striking enough. Finally, I tell you, it looked real good, she assured them, and sat staring into the fire on her tired old face, the supreme content of an artist who has realized his ideal.
This is from a novel by Margaret Walker called Jubilee. The house was enough excitement, but Viry fairly burst with pride and interest in the quilts. There were six quilts, and each housewife had a different pattern. Mrs. Shackelford was making the Rose of Sharon for her daughter, Giddy Alice, and every woman oohed and aahed over her workmanship. She was going to quilt it with the big rosy flowers, known to some as single hibiscus, outlined in her most exquisite stitching. Mrs. Lapsley was quilting the Star of California, and she had used a combination of red and blue calico for the huge six-cornered star, while a third lady, Mrs. Blake, was making the Star of Texas in brilliant red and white. Perhaps the most original pattern was a monkey wrench used by Mrs. McElroy, with each monkey wrench in a different color on a field of white and brown. The double wedding ring was Mrs. Medford's pattern, with pastels for the interlocking circles. Viry was making pomegranates with deep orange fruit, green stems and leaves on a white background. Each woman sewed industriously through the morning, and at dinner time, they compared notes with admiring glances and comments to see how much they had accomplished.
I think it's the next one. Okay, the event that Mary Lou just read about was a quilting bee where the women all came and they brought their own patterns and sewed on their separate pieces. The way it works is that each person makes her own quilt top with from all the pieces. Most often this is the way it's done. And then when it's time to attach the top to the bottom, it's done by the in and out plain stitching of on a quilting pattern that she draws. And when she gets that quilting pattern drawn all over her own quilt, but she's already sewed all the pieces of the top together, then she attaches it to a frame and you have a quilting bee. And this is what's going on here. These things here are called rollers. And this is the very beginning of the quilting bee here. In a painting, a primitive painting, you can see the explanation down here. And they start at the edge doing the quilt pattern, which is not the sewing of pieces together, but the in and out kind of thing. And they all do it together. They try to get coordinated. And when they finish this little piece here, then they're going to say, ladies, you ready to roll? And they're going to roll this. They're going to unpeg the edges, and they're going to roll it in towards the middle, and then they're going to start on the next row. And that's the way the whole thing gets quilted together. This is probably made by one woman. She's pieced all her pieces together. And then she has the party. Now, the patterns that come through these things are incredible. Quilting is an art that comes from Asia, from China, but it was going on to a certain extent in England and the continent, and the people who came to the United States brought the whole idea of quilting with them. But what happened when they got here was they fell under the influence of patterns on Indian, American Indian patterns. So that the great age of American quilting, which starts in 1848, of a whole burst of new patterns, all with different names, you've seen some of the names here, seems to have to do with a number of things. But one of them is the influence of American women coming into contact with
The designs, the Navajo designs, all the different kinds of use of patterns and shapes that the American Indians were already doing in their art. Now, it wasn't just a social event. The event had two parts. First, the woman was sitting there all by herself sewing the thing together after she's done all her heavy farm work. One 19th century woman said, "I would have lost my mind if I had not had my quilts to do." Then it's the coming together socially. Now, they got together around these things on certain ritual occasions. It was not just done haphazardly. There was a quilting party for every event in a woman's life. You have the puberty one. I think some of you may have seen the Waldens or whatever that program is called. When it's decided that the girl is of marriageable age by all the women in the locality, then they have a quilting booth. And the girl in the Waldens didn't want to have it because it embarrassed her too much, as it well might. Then when you get engaged, you make your masterpiece. You yourself piece your marriage quilt together. And that's yet supposed to be a girl's 13th quilt. She's supposed to have done 13 quilts before that. Now, they taught the children to quilt before they taught them to read. And, of course, sometimes they didn't teach the girls to read at all, but they were taught to hold a needle and quilt at about the age of three. So they were supposed to have made 13 quilts, and the marriage quilt is the 13th. Then there were, of course, quilt makings for when you were going to have a baby. There were mourning or memory quilts, which sound macabre, but seem kind of interesting. Those are entirely made out of the clothes of somebody you know who has died. I don't know about that. Then there were friendship quilts, and the friendship quilts are very interesting. I've got an inscription poem from a friendship quilt up on the board at the back of the room. In those, each woman would bring a separate square of her own design, and she would put her signature in it, in embroidery. And they would get together and sew it all together and then quilt it all together at a very important time in a woman's life. It could be when she was moving away. Very frequently, if somebody was moving on to another settlement on the frontier, she would get a friendship quilt as she moved from all her woman friends with each of their names on it. It would be sometimes the whole community would get together to give it to somebody who had been very ill. But those friendship quilts were made of separate patterns, each from the woman's design, and then sewed together. Now, this would be all day. My informant is George Stewart, a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin, and she told me how when she was snowed in one time, she lived in the country in Iowa, and she stayed in the city, and all the children from the school just got together and had a quilting duty that went on for 5 or 6 hours. And the women can get together, and they're usually thought of as gossiping and being trivial. Now here, they're having some shape notes singing over here. See, there are two people singing, and there's music, and they're all singing. You can tell something very important about this event, which is from the memory of this old woman, by looking at this person over here. I don't know if you've seen very well. He is not a part of it. I don't know what he's doing in the picture, but you can see that, I mean, why he's there at all. His face is turned away. He's very much not a part of it. Now, what happened with this is that the women used the quilting bees as a way of getting together and talking apart from the men. Very rarely would a man actually be in the room. And the men all said, "Oh, those women are just over there doing all that quilting. You know, it's not anything very important anyway." Well, I mentioned the great age of American quilting started in about 1848, and it's not a coincidence that Susan B. Anthony gave her first suffrage speech at a quilting gig in Cleveland. It was one of those things that women used seditiously because they were around men all the rest of the time to get together and talk about what they were going to do about the vote and everything like that. So it was not only used for ritual occasions, it was not only used at each point in a woman's life as she matured, grew old, had children, and died. It also was very important to the women's suffrage movement, something like the idea of the little black church in the swamp where they were singing, oh freedom, before I'll be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. whenever they sang that in the black churches in the swamp in Georgia, they beat a great big cauldron so that nobody would hear the words. But this is the way women did it, one of the ways women did it, so that you have a full card of tremendous ancientness coming all the way from Asia and persisting since probably the very beginning of the world, used in all these different ways. Can we have just the last one? Which all goes to show. This character is in a country in Eastern Europe, and somehow the National Geographic disappeared with the explanation. I think it's Bulgaria, but she represents something. I'm not sure how well you can see it, but she has painted, this is a paintbrush. It's off the slide, but at the top you can see it kind of curling around like that on a great set of canes. And she has just painted her entire wall with thousands and thousands and thousands of flowers. And then she's got another border with flowers up here. Then she's got another border with flowers up here. And she's sitting there showing you what she's done. I think she kind of expresses something. I'm not sure what. Okay, can we have the lights? I brought you to look at afterwards two things. One is called the Dresden Plate. I think that's the right name. It's a placemat made of quilting. It's on the back board. And the other is a pine tree that Madeline Doran made. It's not a real quilt. She made it as a hot pad just to illustrate the way the patches go together in a pine tree, and we can look at that afterwards. And now we're going to explain how this all fits in with everything else.
Shall I talk a bit about this? You better, because I don't understand this.
Is I on here? I don't have to. No? I don't have to.
Okay, well, that's right. the quilling thing is really a good illustration of the way people create right out of themselves. Because, of course, they're always using old clothes and things like that. They're never going out and buying material they're going to quilt with in most instances. And you see, they had all these names. The crown of thorns comes from biblical mythology. The pine tree. They made up the names to go with it. And they made up a whole culture that centers around quilts. And if you ever, I got together twice this week with quilting women, one Joy Stewart, professor in the English program, and the other by proxy with the fall of Southern Mississippi to a woman I found out had the double bridal ring. And you get talking to these people, and it's a whole language. It's an arcane code that they've invented around it. And what they've done is they've created their own myth. And we usually think of myth as an abstract thing that has to do with the Greeks or the Romans and nothing to do with us. And the quilting patterns and the quilting rituals and the stories that they tell are an example of the way people bring myths right out of the center of their own lives. We're all myth makers. The quote that I had was from Jung, who said that when a group of people seeks to create a myth for themselves, the group falls apart and dies. We may be in a period of demythologization of America because of what happened to Watergate, this disbelief in the American idea. Myths are constantly being formed, becoming too rigid, no longer applying to people, and dying. The relationship between religion and myth depends on where you are. To a religious person, the pattern of events, the canopy of values that he or she believes in are reality. To a person who doesn't happen to believe in that particular pattern, that religion is a myth, one among a whole series of stories about the world and how it came together and how it was created and what is going on in the world. So a myth is not a lie, it's a creation. And it's relative to the people who make it, and to its being alive in the hearts of the people who make it, and moving them from one place to another as a group and as individuals. Through ritualism.
Okay, I'm going to try to share with you some things which meant a lot to me when I heard them. These are notes from a tape recording that I made during a discussion which was led by Ann Halperin, whom I spoke of last week. And for those of you who weren't there last week, she's primarily a dancer, but her husband's a community planner and architect, and together they have worked out something called the RSVP cycle, which is their approach to creating myths and rituals in a group of people. R standing for resources, S standing for store, P standing for performance, and V standing for value action, which is a made-up word, which means re-evaluating all the while it's going on. Now, I'm just going to read you some things that she said that I got off of this tape. She spoke about rituals of affirmation, celebration, which is reaffirming and claiming parts of yourself that fill you with joy. She spoke of rituals of exorcism, and I'm not going to go into that as she did right now. She spoke of rituals of initiation and rituals of transformation. I think an example of transformation would be passing from one stage of life into another. In the theater and the dance, we ritualize, act out the parts of our being which we can't express usually. Medea kills her children. The audience says, she played that role beautifully. If you do these things in dance or in theater, you don't have to do them on the streets. You don't have to go crazy. She spoke of herself as looking for processes which would allow people to be totally liberated as artists and not cut themselves off by shoulds and shouldn'ts and competition. On the street brings to mind something she said somewhere else during the evening. She said that in San Francisco just that year, a ritual or a myth was performed on a bus. A bunch of people on the bus were just riding along home when several stood up and said, okay, put your hands up, we're going to rob you. And they not only robbed everybody on the bus, or whatever they had in San Francisco. Streetcars? I don't think it was a cable car, I probably remember that. But they not only robbed them, they beat up on them. And then they got off. And this was a case of performing their, whatever you want to call it, myth or ritual or event. They performed it all right. They performed it in the street. And her point here is you do this in theater or in dance or in some other kind of setting where it can be done without harming anybody, and you can get this out of yourself. Or even watching an idea may tend to exercise those feelings within each of us. The notion of killing our kids, for instance, is maybe something be better to exercise by watching a play, no matter how horrible the play, than to carry it out. Now she spoke of what we dance about. We could say here what we have a ritual or a performance about. We have the ritual about what is real in our lives. We don't have to make up stories. We don't, oh, and then she says, who do we do it for? We don't share what is deep with just anybody. Sharing is important. She spoke of a young man who was part of her company who finally did a dance of, I suppose, of initiation. And the only people present were some of the people he works with every day and his parents. And he arranged them, his audience, in a very special way, and he did it in his own backyard, I believe. He carried this thing out in a way that had a lot of meaning to him and which gave some meaning to the people that he cared about. Where shall the ritual be performed? This is important, she said. Should we perform it in a street, in a park, in a yard, in homes? She told about what they're doing out there, a workshop for San Francisco. This is a public event that they're doing for free for anybody that will show up. And they chose to perform at the San Francisco Museum of Art, which is right opposite City Hall and beside the Opera House. And she spoke of these establishment places and how they're going to, when they come, they do this every month, when they come to the spring, when they're going to just from right out in the open space among these three establishment locations. And they, at that point, when they're outdoors, their event will be making a statement of what they want from the establishment, what they want for San Francisco. Okay, I spoke about who you do it for and where you do it. Now, who is going to do it is important. In this case, since this is for San Francisco, hundreds of people show up each of these monthly events, and probably by the spring one, there might be a couple of thousand people present. People right off the street, anyone who comes. And their goal is to transform the city of San Francisco. She then spoke about walking. And of course, I can insert here, it's not to transform the city into what she wants or what the other members of her group want. It's, if they're trying to transform it, they're trying to transform it into what all these participants want collectively. Then she talked about walking, and that's what I spoke about last week. Walking is our dance. She says the whole city is dancing walking. Walking is our signal, too. And, of course, their first workshop with the people that came to it, the people off the street, who dealt almost entirely with walking. Then she talks about how can each of us contribute uniquely to the collective experience. And then she gave an example from one of these workshops, which we used a little bit of last week. It was this stop, look, and listen process. Someone, anyone, yells stop, and then the same person or anyone else says, look, listen, and then tells the whole group his idea or her idea of an action to perform. For example, someone shouted out, stop, look, listen, we'll be a choo-choo train. And the group lined up behind the woman who had a baby strapped to her back, and they went around and choo-chooed around the area. Another person said, we're Romeo and Juliet, and our ecstasy is so great we have a heart attack. And they all performed this in their individual ways. And another one said, stop, look, listen, and he was way up on a parapet of some sort. I'm God, and you're all my archangels. So they did with that little score what they seemed to, you know, what each person felt was appropriate following that score. And she made the point that sharing fantasies and allowing ourselves to be silly fits into this thing. There are rituals in every society. In the tribal arts, which are seen in societies that have been isolated, you have the visual aspect, the sound aspects, the humanistic aspects, the environmental aspects, the social responsibility aspects, and the sacred aspects. They are all one thing, she said, not separated. Every ritual incorporates all these aspects. She speaks about food sharing as a ritual. I'm going to get to some more on that. She says, here's what she's talking about, what she means that rituals are. Rituals are arriving at symbols that become an artifact, a symbolization of particular moments in your life that have to do with growth and change. You don't ritualize everything. You ritualize the moments that signify. Eating is a very good model of a ritual that symbolizes a joining, a coming together. And then she talked a little bit about our memories of the ritual of placement at the table in our families. She said most of us came from families where the father sat at the head of the table. And she says this is something that affected every one of us, established our relationships. I asked her some questions because I knew that I was coming back to this fellowship. And I said, suppose we wanted to develop rituals for marriage, divorce, death, and so forth. And wanted to have rituals available at hand for people who might choose to use them. I said, how is this different from the spontaneous thing you've been talking about? She says, well, that comes after there's a process of selectivity that goes on within a group of people. It's very important that the rituals are reevaluated and recycled until they get to a point where they can be accepted and are selected by the community. But just to plan a ritual and say, this is it, and it's a blueprint, that's not going to work. It won't hold. It has to go through a series of recyclings. Okay, we did this ritual. Well, then, and then she spoke again about that workshop for San Francisco. We had 300 or 400 people writing to us, this is what I like, this is what I didn't like, this is what my experience was. If I were to do it again, I would want to do this, this, or this. You go through a whole reevaluation. What worked? What didn't work? What were some of your experiences? Well, let's do it next time, and let's do it this way. Now we have more resources. Let's add this to it. Or let's take this out. Until finally you recycle and recycle, and there's a natural selectivity, and that takes repetition. And so I asked, so with each succeeding death, for instance, the community would handle it and reevaluate it. And she inserted, yes, and what you didn't like about it? Oh, what didn't you like about it? How was it meaningful? Or were there parts of it that didn't feel right? Until you find something that seems really to work. And some man inserted in that community. And the fact that they've shared it before makes it more meaningful, I commented. And she said, but they know there's a process that at any time they can add and subtract. They can bring new input into it. The moment a ritual becomes static, it's surely going to become empty. Because if it's too rigid, it's not inclusive enough. It doesn't allow for the now. So that's the notes I wanted to share with you. Who do you know?
Well, there was some good discussion last time, and I wrote down, I've just been taught to do something by some of my colleagues in the German department. It's called make a protocol. And all that means is that when you're engaged in discussion, you write down what you pick up from it and bring it back the next time so that you don't always start at a brand new place. And it's a pretty interesting technique. So I wrote a little thing down about what various people said, and maybe I'll read it now. Maybe that'll start discussion.
Sure.
And then we want some more of the same type of discussion we did last time. And then, of course, we can't possibly leave here today without doing the ritual, so we've invented one, which we will do at 11 o'clock. Is Lois answering? She said last week that an individual, the problem for her with a group ritual is that an individual may have a completely individual response, a completely response coming from themselves, and then the group seems to be coming from an entirely different place, and the individual gets drawn into the group in spite of the fact that she has a different response, and finds herself performing some entirely different motion and gesture than she originally had intended. I keep feeling that Lois didn't like that feeling. But it is true that you do get drawn into a group, and the balance between your individuality and the collective creativity is a difficult problem. And we all know historical examples of people who got drawn into a group by interest in a gesture. I'm doing it out like this because it's Kyle Hitler. Gestures that appealed to someplace and it was not a good place to have it. To appeal when you might have wanted to have withdrawn. So there's the individual group problem. Hermine said something wonderful, and I only got a little piece of it. Maybe you can help me with it. The gestures, even I felt that you were saying individual gestures, little pieces, a single line of speech, have a cohesiveness within a distinctive non-individual context. Do you want to, by which I felt you meant racial and national characteristics that seem to come into our language and gestures themselves. Would you want to expand on that a little bit? You said that.
The thing about movement is that movement speaks in its own language. If you begin to try to be too wordy about what movement means, you describe the very thing that you're trying to do. And the experience of movement can be very personal. It can also be very groupy. And I think the thing that Lois was trying to say is that sometimes you feel as if you're poured into a mold and you can't get out of it. This often happens in folk dance situations in which somebody says, don't do it that way because that isn't the way the Hungarians do it. very frequently you do kill a dance experience by A, being too specific about how you have to do it, or B, not allowing for the fact that some people simply don't move that way, they don't reflect the emotion, they're no longer. Back in my New York days, when Ann Cowper and I were both at the Grand Studio, many of us were pulling a part-time job somewhere, and Francis Gabois, whose father was Franz Gabois, a very famous anthropologist, was teaching at Bellevue because someone who was back in the 30s and 40s had the idea that they could dance with free of some people who had problems. And so this, she had a group of young ladies who had problems. And she one time took some very marvelous drugs which her father allowed her to use from his collection of beautiful materials over this group of value to try and stimulate these kids into doing something. And this one boy who had withdrawn pretty much from the group was cued by these drugs, and he got into the act, and he beat hell out of a drum, and he just had a wonderful time, and then he danced after having beat the drum. At the end of the session, Francis just said to him, Joe, you know, that reed was marvelous. What did you call that? And he said, I called it the stroke of the dancing teacher. True story.
I think that's a perfect illustration. I was thinking, said something about, well, you don't have to go crazy. And then he did it to Dalva. I said, you don't have to go crazy because you can make a crazy quilt. crazy quilt is this. Every kind of pattern, triangles, squares, rectangles. Hodgepodge. Yeah.
In the very, very issue of this one, which is a good issue anyway, it's a long arm for my parents to talk for travelers. Almost like Snapchat's travel from Charlie Harris, it's all very good. It's great to describe. But in that, there's also an article by John Vivian, who's a writer, but she describes a quilt that came from her family made by a woman on a long, hard Western trip. And the quilt is a mass of stitches, so that you cannot see the cloth. There's so many stitches. And she says she thinks the woman was having such a hard time that when she reached the end of the quilt, she had nothing else to express her what was happening to her, so she just kept stitching. And she still has to do it, so she looks at it. She knows what the woman went through, children who died, farms that didn't work out, husbands who didn't work out.
What was the next one?
It's the February issue of this.
The reason I ask is that Joyce is trying to put together a collection of quilts on birds. I thought it might be fun to get the National Memory of Humanities lecture and use that up at your talk book. For the summertime, go from town to town in Wisconsin doing a quilt demonstrations and exhibitions. You know something?
Largely
an activity that can be repeated on. You have a whole myth of Christianity in which you have the ritual of the Last Supper, the ritual of Jesus, as part of that narrative.
Well, I guess relating this to prayer, for example, here we have people who have different beliefs and beliefs or attitudes, and there's no coherence, common point of view, I don't think, or else it's then we've articulated to me. And so therefore, there's no myth among the subconscious, I would say. So then the rituals become also, whatever rituals exist here become very fragmented because the rituals are cut off from what is existing. This idea of discussing heavy rituals as spontaneity and celebrated life, I mean, I think that that's certainly makes a lot of sense, but I would just wonder with respect to this group who is searching for whatever people come to commune together about the lack of the creative problems and the lack of structure.
Well, taking
up
the
myth
as a system,
fairly
rigid system, the myth of Christianity, the myth of Zen Buddhism, the myth of communism, the myth of capitalism, taking it as a fairly set system, you're of course absolutely right. But it just a canopy of values that can be defined in its own terms. And you're absolutely right about prairie. I think that's the challenge. I see prairie more as a patchwork quilt of all different patterns. And it's a patchwork quilt that doesn't get sewn together. They kind of, you know, like a kaleidoscope thing? Kind of like that. That's an excellent question because that's the problem, right?
Yeah, and listen to this. I was thinking that anything that has to be had, it seems to me some way to make the view of paradigm is the search.
It's the search.
Yeah.
Is the picking up of and casting aside of values and the picking up and casting aside, the search through a multiplicity of possibilities. Yeah, and I think that came out of what Mary Lou said. This is one of the hardest things I think for human beings to live with. I remember Reinhold Niebuhr saying once that most religions have a set pattern. Protestants alone walk naked in the desert with nothing, not a symbol, not a bell, not a chalice, nothing. True Protestants walk naked in the desert.
Except they feel they have the truth.
Get out of my
I don't think, because we were not in any way designed to work, there's any problem with me.
No, I don't, I didn't, I meant the bringing out of the group of some ceremonies that they like to do might be a problem, since there is the rather common consensus on any really rigid mitzvah. Yeah, that's the whole thing about the history of religion, I think, is that, you know, a lot of the talks of religion started out very spare, throwing out the rituals that they had found ossified, and the next thing you know, they swept the house clean, and seven new devils have come in, and you've got a whole bunch of new things that a whole bunch of new people have to throw out. So it's very much in that spirit of folks that is a good one.
knows each other, and I think that things are more in the nature of happenings. And I remember a happening that was very, very funny in the city of Tacoma. Maybe we have to talk about the details, but it was a die-in that the community had when the Army was shipping the trying to decide where they were going to put the inert gas, and they determined that they were going to ship it through the city of Tacoma. And just spontaneously, the people got together at a big intersection in town, and all pretended that they were dying. And the cars stopped, and they hang out of their windows.
That actually there was something in common all of a sudden among all those people. They have that
big concern.
Nobody
said, let's get together now and we're going to do... I think things happen greater spontaneity.
I think it's also observed on these guys in Madison that one of those protest meetings, there's a whole bunch of students who are walking with traffic at the corner of Park and Johnson.
Writing a two-volume, 1,200-page work on archetypes, so maybe you might get to get it with me another time. Do you want to explain?
Well,
save your seats. Then the chicken fuckers after we explain.
Yeah. If the children come in, include them in what we're going to do. The chicken fuckers are going to provide the music, and if you want, you can start gathering wherever you want to gather chicken fuckers. Another thing based on circular motion, and it's also based on walking. You can call it a dance, but the only step you need to know is how to walk. It has three parts, all walking. We'll learn it in one big circle, but then because of the size of the room, we'll form a circle within a circle to actually perform it. I'm going to tie this into what I said before. Our resources, that's the R. Our resources are ourselves, our music makers. One song which many of us know, about 10 minutes of time in this big room. Our score has three parts. The first and third part are closed. In other words, Annis and I, with her main help, planned these parts. The middle part is a more open score. It's limited by the length of the one verse of the song, but it's open enough that each of you has a chance to put in some actions of your own. And our value action, our evaluation, I think can come afterwards. When you're breaking up, talk to someone that you don't usually talk to after the service, and for a minute or two, share your reactions to what we've just done. What you liked about it, what you didn't like, how you'd like to do it differently if we ever did it again. Now, for the performance, we're going to get all the chairs out of the way just as quickly as you can.
Just before we do that, I ask for something? Could I ask for anybody who'd like to write down on an index card some rituals that go on in their own lives to do so sometime and get it to me in about 3 weeks or something like that? Because I think it'd be interesting to have that feedback.
Rituals in your own life?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Or that you remember like the ones at first.
Okay, so get the chairs out of the way as quickly as possible and make a circle.
Yes.
Starting with the grand high.
What sympathetic vibration is, what would be strings, you see? These strings are set up and set.
Is this a chromatic scale?
Some things are hard to think about.